Gusty winds, it ties around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold blood. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health and the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerting, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Colder than a ticket taker smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a lone gust wind in the bedroom.
And, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connection. Daryl Bradford Smith, your host today on this great day to be listening to talk radio. It's the fifth day of January in the new year here. It's a Thursday. We've got an incredible interview waiting for us at the bottom of the hour with Lieutenant Commander Jim Innes. He was the officer of the deck on the USS Liberty, ladies and gentlemen, when they were ruthlessly and savagely attacked by the Israeli Army and Air Force and gunboats. And I mean, it was a slaughter. This was an undefended information gathering ship. They tried to sink this ship. Ultimately, we have figured out after the fact that they wanted to blame it on the Egyptians so that the Americans would go to war with Egypt. Now, it failed, over 30 people were murdered in this assault, and hundreds were injured, including Jim Innes, the officer of the deck that day. He was a lieutenant on that horrible day. And it goes to modus of what presently is happening in the New York area. And ladies and gentlemen, this is not the first time the Zionists have attacked Americans and killed us. In order to blame it on another group. And, of course, this time they're blaming it on Arabs again, as they did in 1967. And so far, they have gotten away with the lie. But people are waking up. You know, I was trying to call in a radio station in Massachusetts where they had a mainstream media person speaking on a radio show saying that, well, the mainstream media hasn't really reported the news lately because they were afraid of George Bush. And they were afraid of repercussions. And I called this station and I said, well, how does that explain why the French didn't report the truth? And why the British didn't report the truth? And the Spanish? And the Germans? And the Italians? And, and the Canadians? And the Australians? Is it all because they were afraid of George Bush? No. It's not because they were afraid of George Bush. It's because the worldwide press is owned and operated by Zionists. And that's why the truth has never been printed. And not because George Bush can reach his arm across the Atlantic Ocean and stop journalists in European countries from sharing the truth. The simple fact of the matter is what's happening now is the mainstream media is trying to lie to us again by saying that George Bush is responsible for all the messes we're in and that Dick Cheney is responsible. Ladies and gentlemen, look at George Bush. This man is not capable. He is barely capable of a sentence in public or private. And you think this man has the power to control the press in the world. If you think that's true, boy, you need your head examined. The simple fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, we are up against a very well-organized APEC, ADL, JDL, Abramoff, Foxman, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Libby. The list is endless. Melman, we can go on and on. How about all the moguls in that won't make the propaganda movies out of Hollywood. Jesus. How about the Bronfman family? How about the Rothschilds? How about the Warburgs? Jesus. How about the Goldmans, the Kahns? Ladies and gentlemen, I mean, these are not Jesuits. They're not George Bush. George Bush is a useful idiot to these people. It's time we started wrapping our brains around the villains here. And unless and until we're able to do that, we're not going to get any traction against them. And, of course, they are working overtime to blame George Bush for all this. Now, of course, George Bush is part of it. Don't make the mistake of thinking that he wasn't part of this mess. He was. And Dick Cheney was. But they are not the orchestrators of this stuff. They are simple, useful idiots for these controlling interests. Kissinger above him goes the money people, above them goes people like Conrad Black and Bronfman and Sumner Redstone. And, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to take a look at this realistically. And unless and until we do, we're not going to make headway. It is not the New World Order we're fighting. It is not. Simply not. It's Zionism, ladies and gentlemen. International Zionism. Go to my website and listen to the 1961 Benjamin Friedman interview, and he'll explain to you what Zionism is. He was one of them. He was there during the Balfour document signatures. He was there when Woodrow Wilson gave away the peace to Germany and ripped Germany off and caused World War II at the behest of 120 Zionists who arrived at the League of Nations meeting with Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a sellout, ladies and gentlemen, was a sellout, like all the presidents have been for many, many generations in our country. But for the first time in our long history, we are fighting back. We are taking back the truth. We are supplying the truth to the many, ladies and gentlemen, and this battle is now just getting underway. Stop believing it's the New World Order. Stop believing it's the globalists. Ask these people, who are you talking about? It's too amorphous a term, globalist. New World Order. Who are the people? Name the names. Put a face to them. Put an address to them. Where are they? Who's APEC? Who's Abe Foxman? Who is Abramoff? Why is he giving free trips on gambling boats to Muhammad Atta? Why is a Mossad agent walking around southern Florida saying that his name is Muhammad Atta, using Muhammad Atta fake documents? Why are things like this happening? Why are Israelis murdering our troops in Iraq? Bombing them with roadside bombs. Why, ladies and gentlemen? Explain it to me. Why did... Look into the Levon affair. Look up Gladio on your computer. Just why is Netanyahu standing above the bomb site during an explosion in London in July? Why, ladies and gentlemen? These are questions we all should be asking. Stop saying these amorphous things such as the New World Order and Satanism and all the rest of this nonsense. It's criminal Zionists, plain and simple. Wrap your brain around it or run for the hills when we come back, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. I'm on fire today. We are fighting the big fight, and we've got my friend Renee in North Carolina waiting to fight it up with me. Renee, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Daryl.
Hi, Renee.
Well, I tell you what, I wanted to talk, you know, about Abramoff. I have trouble saying his name.
Yeah, Abramoff, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, now, doesn't he pride himself on being an Orthodox Jew?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Now, there are many types of sects within the Jewish community, and I would not say that there are Hasidim, which are the ones that are very adherent to Torah, Judaism. They are staunch anti-Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
There's another group of these folks that are not, and they come from the Khazar group.
Mm-hmm.
They were just north of Iran, north of Persia. They were converted to Judaism back in after Babylon fell, when the Jews wandered north, and they ended up converting this whole group of people, and that's who became the Ashkenazis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the group you're thinking of, and that's the Zionists. That's the ones where Rothschild's from, and Warburg, and Goldman, and Kahn, and all of these people. And yes, they do have Orthodox people within their religion, but they're Orthodox Zionists. The leadership is.
Well, that's just it. And the thing is, he also, from what I can understand, is a huge fan of the Godfather movie. And he also, this is the deal, too. It's like, they say how much money he was spreading around. I want to know what's the source of all that money.
Let me tell you where he got the money.
I think I know. I think what happens is what they do is the money we send to Israel,
mm-hmm.
that they send back to buy off our politicians
bingo.
With our money.
Bingo, 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 bingo. And by the way, you know they give 50 times more money to Israel every year than they give to the state of Massachusetts. And now listen to this. Israel has 4 million people. State of Massachusetts has 8 million. And they get 50 times the amount of money. You figure it out.
Well,
we've got a Congress bought and paid for, ladies and gentlemen. Bought and paid for.
There are hundreds of countries in this world that we never hear of. Their leaders come and go and die and get new ones, and it never hits the radar screen of our news. But oh, Sharon sneezes. Anything happen in Israel, and it's all over our news. You'd swear there were two countries on the earth. You know, you look at our news, and there are some people that don't end up on here at all. And it's like, how come they get so much coverage on our news?
He is a war crimes person, a mass murderer.
Mm-hmm.
He sent in Christian militiamen to mass murder people in a refugee camp in central Beirut. This man is a murderous, filthy, odious monster, and has done nothing in this world except spread murder and hate all over the place. That anywhere that he arrives, there's murder and hate in his wake.
Well, that's just it. I don't think I'm going to miss him. And I'm like you, Daryl. You know, I am not a person that dislikes any group of people. I try to take people on an individual level.
That's
right. I really like what Martin Luther King said, how we need to judge people on the content of their character. But the problem is, when a Jew turns out to not have any character, if you say it, well, you're an anti-Semite.
Well, see, but that, see, now that might be, that might have been true in the past. Renee, that may have been true in the past, but if you've been going to my website, you'll find out that I've got a lot of Jewish people supporting my fight. I've got hundreds of thousands in the Hasidic community, and I've got two rabbis I speak to almost every day. And I am not anti-Jewish. I'm anti-criminal Jew.
Oh, I know. And see, I'm with you there, because I just wanted to clarify that, because I know you, I've heard you for a long time, Daryl, and you know, some people, if they're just tuned in, might think something like that, but it's like, you know, and some people who want to believe that, who would maybe like to paint you or me or anybody else because we're critical of a certain segment of the Jewish population, like I said, I am very liberal in this area, and that's, I am not from a conservative, sexist or racist part of the ideology, and I just, you know, I want to make sure that people don't misunderstand that, and I really am glad you are getting support from that segment of the community. And you know what, I tell you what, there's one thing good that's liable to come out of this Abramoff thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal supposedly reported that this could lead to problems for 60. And if the Wall Street Journal is conservative as they are, if they're saying 60, if they're admitting to 60, like I said, there must be a lot of scared people in Washington right now. I can only hope, because you know, the people are so asleep, Daryl. it's going to take a massive thing, not one, two, or three. People just get over that. It's going to take where a lot of them get caught and to kind of wake people up. And I saw how Newt Gingrich was saying if the Republicans didn't want to have this really, you know, give them problems, they were going to have to get out in the front of this and to do the reform for lobbying and stuff. But you know what? The thing is, you see, they're almost blaming it on the lobbyists. You know, no matter what the lobbyists do, I don't care if they wave 10 prostitutes in front of you or you know, whatever. The thing is, the lobbyists are not necessarily the problem. Just because somebody offers you something or tempts you with something, you don't have to take it.
That's right.
So, if you see, they're trying to push this as on a lobbyist problem, but this is an integrity problem.
Well, you have to understand, Renee, can I interject here for a second? What they do is they find people of low moral character early on in their careers, and they are the ones who they promote. And so what you've got is from day one, most of these people who are promoted through the ranks have already been compromised from the beginning. And so as they make their climb up the ladder of success within the political structure, they are already bought and paid for. There isn't any problem with buying them later. They're purchased early on. And how does that work? Well, unless you've been bought and paid for, no one is going to give you money for your campaign. And so if you don't have the money for the campaign, you don't get the airtime, you don't get elected, and the guy that did get that did sell out his soul to the devil, gets that money, and they've got another guy that they can go to when they need him. We need a do-over. We got to get rid of the Democrat and Republican Party. I'm not talking about fixing these parties. I'm talking about eradicating these parties. I'm talking about getting rid of them permanently, and I'm talking about jailing their members.
Oh, absolutely, because the thing is, it's a crime syndicate. They're only interested in promoting other criminals. Like
you're honest,
you're not going to be promoted.
If these people are convicted in a court of law of taking money in any way from lobbyists to manipulate our political structure, they need to be put in prison for 20 years. Right now, 5% of our population in the world, do you know we've got 28% of the world's imprisoned people?
Yeah. And
the most sickening thing.
Yes.
Oh, boy. I get so sick to my stomach sometimes, Renee. You have no idea. Renee?
I hear the music.
Thank you so much, Renee. Keep listening because we've got Lieutenant Commander Jim Ennis from the Liberty. And, boy, is he going to blow the roof off of today's show.
Okay.
Say, see you later. And, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We are back. We are back. Darryl Bradford Smith, French Connection. Great to have you with me here on this Thursday. It is a great day for truth telling, ladies and gentlemen. And boy, are we going to tell you some truth right now with my guest and I hope soon to be calling him friend, his Lieutenant Commander Jim Ennis. Jim, are you with me?
Hey, I'm with you, Darryl.
Well, we're gonna tell some truth today, Jim. You know, back in 64, you went into the military. Is that correct?
Actually, I first went into the Navy in 51, but I was commissioned in 62, and this event occurred in 67.
That's right. And at the time of this incident, and let's set the stage for this, you were on an information gathering ship called the USS Liberty, and it was about just past the international waters line off the coast of Israel between, where exactly? Off the Sinai? Between Egypt and Israel? Where exactly was the Liberty?
Exactly. We were about 13 miles off the coast, just out of the claimed international waters, and near the town of El Arish, between Egypt and Israel.
Okay. And so on this day, and what day was it? What part of the year was it exactly, Jim?
This was June 8, 1967.
Okay, and you were officer of the deck just prior to this incident. And if anybody doesn't know what that means, is for all intents and purposes, you were in charge of the ship for that time while the captain was either in his ready room or wherever else. Is that correct also?
That's right. Yeah, the captain usually wanders around the ship and takes care of his own business and leaves the management of the ship and the navigation and so forth to an officer on the bridge, and this day that was me.
Well, now, and the closest next ship to you or was a task force including the USS America and the Saratoga. How far away from you were these two ships?
A good 300 miles, maybe 350.
Mm-hmm. And so you were there pretty much alone, and you were there on an information gathering mission because there was a lot of tension erupting in Israel in 1967 between Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and Syria. Was there not?
That's right. It was obvious to anybody reading newspapers that the area was close to erupting in war. So we're out there to keep an eye on that, and incidentally, at the same time, to keep an eye on the Soviets in Egypt.
And so there was a lot of reasons why, and you know, this was under Nasser, I believe, was the leader of Egypt at that time, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah.
And so now what we ended up having is that all of a sudden you saw a couple of jets starting to do observational flyovers, didn't you?
That's right. I took the watch at 7:15 in the morning, and I was offshore the deck from 7:15 until almost 12 o'clock. And moments after I took the watch, a single jet passed by the ship, fairly low, maybe 1,000 feet or so above us. And we didn't think a lot of it. I mean, here it was obviously an Israeli airplane, and we expected to be watched closely. They went by, and then a few minutes later, the senior intercept operator down below, Chief Melvin Smith, who died in the attack, came up the bridge, and he asked me, he says, "Were you just circled by an airplane, an Israeli airplane?" I said, "I was." And he said, "Well, we picked up their communications. They know we're American, and they reported so to their headquarters."
And now they were flying the a very advanced French Mirage, weren't they?
That's right. Yeah.
And at the time, I if I'm not mistaken, the Mirage was one of the world's best fighter jets, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So now, how long did these flyovers continue?
Well, initially there was that one, and then an hour or so later there was another, and then during the morning there were eight separate incidents, most of which I saw, in which they circled sometimes as low as 200 feet directly overhead. Sometimes they passed so close overhead that they actually rattled the deck plating. Now, that's low.
Yeah, that's sure.
Sometimes they were jets. Sometimes they were a big twin-engine Nord Atlas, we call a flying boxcar.
Yeah, I know the aircraft. And so now, what was happening here? Okay, your colors were flying. You had them on the main mast. Where were your colors at that particular time?
They were flying from the main mast.
So, and clear to see from anybody. In fact, from 1,000 feet, you could see the American colors, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my orders to the lookouts on the bridge and the quartermasters were to keep an eye on that flag, and if it ever wraps around the mast, as they sometimes do, be sure it is immediately straightened out and just flying freely. Mm-hmm. And also, almost as soon as I took the watch, I saw that the flag we were flying, which we had flown all the way across the Mediterranean for the previous week, was dirty from soot. And I ordered that replaced with a new flag. So we had clean, new, bright colors flying all morning before the attack, easily seen.
Now, what was this? How large was this ship? 450 feet?
That's right.
And was it a 600 PSI main steam kind of ship?
Pardon me?
650 PSI main steam? What kind of boilers were you running on that ship?
I can't tell you how much steam we generated. It was a diesel-powered steam ship.
Ah, okay. Now, so as this stuff developed, Jim, when did you become aware that there was an aggressive nature to these flights?
Actually, we were pretty well convinced that their looking us over so closely was the best thing that could happen to us because they were supposed to be our friends, and obviously if they identified us, which we knew they had, we were safe. And so we had a general quarters drill at 1 o'clock. I came back on the bridge as officer, or counting officer at least, for the for that period from 1 to 2 o'clock. And just as that drill was ending at 2 o'clock and I was transferring the con back to another officer, the radarman picked up on radar three high-speed surface craft approaching the ship at about 16 miles away, just coming over the horizon. You can see from our 50 feet or so above the water, you can just about see 16 miles. And at that point here, there are these boats coming over the horizon. Now, they were coming from the direction of Tel Aviv, Israel. And we thought, hey, that's good. They're coming out to visit us. In fact, the captain had been saying all day, they're going to come out by boats early this afternoon and take a look at us. And sure enough, here they were.
So still no reason to be suspicious that you're in any danger. So now it's just after 2. You've returned the comm to another officer. Well, when we come back, we're gonna continue with the story, Jim. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Lieutenant Commander Jim Ennis, retired U.S. Navy, and we're gonna get into this from soup to nuts, and tell you a story that's going to really shake you up. Don't go anywhere. Smooth sounds of Miles Davis, and we're having a very powerful discussion here with Lieutenant Commander Jim Ennis. He was officer of the deck the day of the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. Jim, I want to go right back to you on this. You know, you transferred your command back. You were leaving. It's 2 o'clock. Did you go back to your berth, or what did you do, and when did you realize that things had gone terribly wrong?
Well, one of my collateral duties was ship's photography officer, and the ship's photographer was there with me. So as soon as I was relieved, we went up to the next deck, the signal bridge, which was four levels above the main deck, where we could take some pictures of these airplanes that were flying by. And three jets were immediately passed over the tops of the torpedo boats that we had seen. So Charles Rowley and I stood on the highest level of the ship next to an open railing while he trained his Nikon on the approaching jets.
And you started snapping pictures, and then what happened, Commander?
Chuck was aiming forward at an airplane that he saw there, and I was looking at another airplane that I saw alongside, and he turned to me and he said, "Mr. Ennis, he's not there, he's dead ahead." And so I switched my glance to dead ahead, and the airplane there suddenly erupted into yellow flames under both wings as it fired a barrage of missiles at us. And we had men in two gun mounts on the ship's forecastle, and they were immediately hit by missiles that blew 6-8-inch holes in the railing around their gun tubs. I saw them go, the men just end over end into the air. Everybody on open decks dropped. There must have been close to a dozen men around me that came up to see these airplanes. And they all dropped. Chuck, the only reason he didn't get shrapnel in his eye is that a piece came right down the barrel, the long barrel of the camera he was looking through. I turned my left side to the heat, which was the first thing I felt, and I was raked with about 50 pieces of shrapnel, one of which broke my left leg. Remarkably, it threw me 4 or 5 feet against another railing, and I was left standing on my one good leg with my broken leg bent just above the knee. And all these guys around me trying to get up and couldn't, and I wasn't in any condition to help anybody. So I hopped down the ladder into the pilot house, and just as the second plane arrived. And that went on for 20 or 25 minutes, just jet after jet after jet firing cannon and missiles. And when the Mirages got through with us, then there was a squadron of Mysteers that carried napalm.
And they did an air blast of napalm just above the ship?
No, the napalm canisters hit the ship and sloshed in through the missile holes that had just been made by the rockets.
Oh man! And so, what spaces were hit? What areas of the ship were hit by the napalm and what holes? What parts of the ship were actually laid open?
Mostly on either side of the bridge, around the motor whale boats and the. And on the port side of the ship, we had two 50-gallon or 55-gallon gasoline drums in an emergency release rack. They were also cut open by the missiles, and so we had 110 gallons of gasoline sloshing around, pouring down ladders that got set afire by the napalm. And so the whole port side of the ship was a solid blaze.
Was the captain able to call a fire brigades for this, or did you just keep watertight integrity? What did you do?
He called away the fire party, and people tried to fight it. There wasn't much really that they could do it because the water, of course, wasn't very effective, and they were being shot at all this time. What many of the men did, which was most effective, was to grab some of the CO2 tanks, turn them on, and just toss the whole tank into the blaze.
Okay.
That worked pretty well, but this...
You guys didn't have PKP and the rest of it on at that time, probably. I remember the PK foam and all that. But
yeah.
So now you're into this battle already. And are you able to... I mean, what's the captain's orders at this point? I mean, is he telling people to get back to the forecastle turrets and start firing at them? Or, I mean, were you able to even get a shot off against them? Were you able to communicate with the Saratoga and the America? What was going on at this point that you know of?
Well, we had some 450 caliber machine guns, and some of those got off some rounds, so not very effectively. And most of the gunners were killed early on, so that didn't do much.
When we come back, Jim, what we're going to do when we come back is set ourselves up for the second half of this, because we only have a 3-minute period in this next segment. So, ladies and gentlemen, stick with us. We're going to set ourselves up for the second half of a very important interview. Don't go anywhere. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is one of the most painful hidden parts of our history, American history, that has had almost no press, and very few people have ever had the courage or the interest in exposing it. And I want to applaud you, Commander, for standing up for yourself and your shipmates. What I'd like to talk about it now, set ourselves up for after this top of the hour break, is your first person experiences, as well as because you've been part of a group trying to get the truth out, some of the testimony from other sailors as to communications that went out to the Saratoga and to the America, and what kind of orders you received back, and all the different parts of this story that so few people know about. I mean, this is supposed to be a friend of ours, a nation that's a friend of ours. Clearly that day, Commander, were they our friends?
Clearly not.
And so, what happened next? I mean, I know you were terribly injured. You were you had a lot of shipmates that were injured. There was fires raging. What did you do next?
Well, I made it down. I was hopped on one leg part of the way and was carried in a gurney the rest of the way down to the main deck on a in an interior passageway while the attack continued. And meanwhile, the torpedo boats came in closer. They got about 1,000 yards away and launched 5 torpedoes at us, one of which hit the ship. Fortunately, the other 4 missed. But one hit the ship and blew a 40-foot hole in the side, killed 25 more men. 9 had been killed by the air attack. There the story really gets twisted because Israel, when they apologized to the United States for this thing, they said that at that point they recognized this as American and apologized and offered to help. And that is the biggest bald-faced lie in the history of the world. They didn't offer help for nearly an hour and a half. What they did was get closer, examine our flag and our markings in English from 50 feet away, circled us close, 50 or 100 feet away from the ship, while machine gunning anything that moved. They were machine gunning the firefighters, the stretcher bearers. It was obvious to them that we're an American ship. We had a huge American flag. Meanwhile, incidentally, that the original flag had been shot down twice, and we replaced it with an oversized flag. It was about 12 feet long. There was no question that they could see our flag.
Now, were they marked? Did you see markings on their boats and on the Mirages that were passing over?
No. Nobody saw any markings on those things. Some people may have seen markings on the torpedo boats close up, but that remains to be resolved. The consensus among the crew is that the aircraft and probably the torpedo boats were unmarked.
Well, when we come back, we've got a 6-minute break, Commander. You can get a cup of tea or stretch your legs for a moment, and then we've got a second half to go through here, sir, and we're making some headway on this truth, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm very proud to have the commander on today. We'll be right back after this break for a message.